Hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is June the 5th, 2025, and this is episode 3683, and it is a Thursday. That means it is time for an expert counsel Q&A show of the week, and I've got a good lineup for you, including some folks that we haven't heard from in a bit. So leading off, as always, or as is usually the case, I should say, not always, but 9 times out of 10, Dr. Paul at the Liberty Report, the Liberty Highlights of the Week, today teaming up with Dan McAdams over there and discussing Elon's post about the big, beautiful bill and the Elon post that was heard around the world about how it really sucks. And it is, in Elon's word, an abomination. I agree. But I also will throw a little reality on top of the fire that you'll hear from Dr. Paul and Dan. Next up, I got a twofer for you like we had last week. I love this one. I have two experts answering the same question back to back. In this case, Nicole Sauce and Ryan Steva. Thoughts on GPS fencing for rotational grazing? This is in specifically for sheep. Now, both Ryan and Nicole do sheep. And Ryan is a specialist in automation on the homestead. Nicole is a specialist in many things on the homestead. And I thought it'd be interesting to hear their takes on this as well. I don't even know what they said yet. I will listen along with you, and maybe I'll add some things. My overall instinct was this really doesn't seem like something I would want to do, especially at a homestead scale. But we'll see, because that's why I sent it to them. I don't have an answer. This is an expert answer. Carrie Brown will talk about foraging safely when you're new to it, and specifically what's known as the universal edibility test. This is something that is often used in survival training, wilderness survival training, and things like that. When you need food, but you don't know what you don't know, and you want to know if this thing is edible. But there is another use for it. Carrie will hit on that, and maybe I'll add a little to it. Chef Ken Daniels will wrap up a 3-episode series on seafood soups and stools today, talking about something called moqueca. I don't know how to pronounce it. How do I know? You will know what it is, and you'll probably want to make it by the time Ken is done today. Then Matt Sersley has a really interesting subject. I know for some it won't seem interesting because as soon as I say insurance, your eyes wash over. But this is specifically, like, I talk often about, like, if you need extra money, do DoorDash, right? Do Uber, do, you know, Uber Eats. Like, and I mentioned, like, hey, you know, you could have a piece of shit jalopy car and you could still do DoorDash. Right, you don't have to have an Escalade and be doing Uber Black to be able to make money with your vehicle. But this does change some things about the type of insurance that you need to carry. And I would say that, like, it's true when you're doing, like, a DoorDash, but it's really true when you're doing, like, a Lyft or an Uber. And you might wonder what the difference is. We'll see what Matt has to say, because I haven't listened to his either. I'll listen to it with you guys. But there's some things that I would say as a non-lawyer, because Matt's going to give you a lawyer's answer, that may not be as important, but it could be if it goes big time, and you'll see when we get there. Then I got something for you. I'm working on my next book already. I really enjoyed putting out the first book, and now that the problems with it are fixed and all the new books shipping are all perfect, I want to start working on my next book. And in it, I'm talking about the fact, one of my laws of life is everybody is a genius, or another way to phrase that would be everybody's an expert at something. And as I was kind of dinking on that today, I started thinking about the Tim Ferriss Become an Expert in 90 Day formula, which was put out in his book that I believe was released in 07 or 08, somewhere about that time. And he had this really cool formula: in 90 days, anybody can become a recognized expert in just about anything. And it basically can be summed up as 8 bullet points, and it works, and it still works today. But today is not 2007 or 2008, right? That's scary as shit. It's just a little bit less than 20 years ago. We have some things today that we didn't have back then. We had podcasts back then, but nobody knew what they were, and very few people listened to them. That'd be one example, but we didn't have AI. Building a website was something you could do then, but nowhere near as sophisticated and fast as can be done today. With some of the features that maybe you could have back then, but they took a lot of money, and now you can do yourself. Those are just a couple examples. So what I did is I, you know, eating my own dog food, as some people put it. I used AI today to develop an outline that updates the Tim Ferriss formula from the 2007-2008 mode into the 2025 mode. As I look at this, I'm going to blow through it in about 15 minutes, like I usually do with my segments at the end of the week. But this could be a whole episode. I could present on this with the same outline I have today for an easy hour and a half, 2 hours. And in the future, we might do a full episode on it. But I realize that like not everybody cares about that subject. Not everybody maybe wants to invest a full podcast in it. So I thought I would break it out today as a segment. You could certainly use it right away. But if there's interest in it, I will definitely consider doing an expanded version of it, along with some other things in that vein as expanded versions. Again, if there is enough interest. Before we do that, let me remind you guys, you can always help us out by doing your online shopping, starting where? tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. And today's item of the day on T-Spaz is the Bitcoin Standard by Safe Dean Amos. And this completes 3 days in sequentially dropping the three most impactful books that I've read in the past 5 years on economics and finance. And they are in order. Safe Dean Amos' The Fiat Standard, which came out after, but I think you should read it first. Then Broken Money by Lynn Alden, which I mentioned yesterday. And then wrap that up with The Bitcoin Standard. Hey, we're going to talk about becoming an expert, recognized expert, on anything in 90 days. And one of the steps is still books. You want to become an expert on Bitcoin and economics recognized as such. Especially in a niche format that we'll talk about when I do my segment. These are the three books. I'm telling you right now, these are the three books. If you have a fundamental understanding of these three books, you have a better understanding of the current economic situation and economic history leading up to where we are than 99.9% of people, including people who went to college with economics degrees. I mean, let's be honest. I can't be an expert in economics. Freaking AOC has a degree from a very prestigious college in economics, and she couldn't put two pennies together and make 2 cents. Or any sense at all. You could give her a bag of pennies. She still doesn't make any sense. You get it? But you, listener, you can become a true expert on economics. You can do that because you want to enact the Tim Ferriss modified new formula I'm going to give you today. Or you can do it just because that's something you want expertise in for your own life. And that's the thing. But when I get to my segment, I want you to realize that you don't want to be a recognized expert. You can still use the same formula, leave some of the promotional things out, and become that expert for your own internal benefit. With that, let's go ahead and drop on into it. Hear from Dan McAdams and Dr. Paul in the Ron Paul Liberty Highlights for the week. Elon's post about the big, beautiful bill that was heard around the world.
And this is, to me, just an absolute expected result of total chaos when a country is totally bankrupt and people around the world are still willing to take our dollar, but less so every single day.
Yeah, Dr. Paul, you know, the noise-to-signal ratio can be high on X. But yesterday at 12:31 p.m., there was a post heard around the world, I think you would call it. And that post, as of this morning, when I clipped it, had been seen by 106.4 million people. That's a big post. And that's when Elon Musk did what I call an Elon quake, an earthquake.
Wow.
Shot heard around the world. And you get the feeling, when I first read it, I got the feeling that Elon Musk had been holding this in as long as he possibly could, biting his tongue, probably bloodying his tongue, biting his tongue, because, of course, he doesn't want to go against the administration. He doesn't want to hurt the president that he likes, that they've gotten along so well. And I don't think he's trying to hurt him. I think he's trying to help. And this is the tweet. This is the post on X. If you haven't seen it yet, you've probably been sleeping. But this is Elon about the big, beautiful bill. Put that first clip up. Very succinct. I'm sorry, but I just can't stand it anymore. This massive, outrageous, pork-filled congressional spending bill is a disgusting abomination. Shame on those who voted for it. You know you did wrong. You know it. That is an extremely powerful post. He followed up a couple minutes later with this next one, if you put that next one on. He goes into detail. It will massively increase the already gigantic budget deficit to $2.5 trillion and burden American citizens with crushingly unsustainable debt. That is a very heavy way in for Elon Musk.
You know, I think what this is revealing, the diagnosis of our problems is coming to the surface, because we have dealt with a lot of people a long time that saw it coming a long time ago. I think my true awakening to the long-term trends of our country and our dollar was way back in 1971. But the diagnosis now is becoming apparent. More people recognize this, and this is sort of a climactic, maybe it is a climactic recognition by an authority that people can't avoid listening to.
Yes. Well, he clearly had more to say than just that initial post. Now, put this next one up. Someone posted about the profligate spending of the GOP, and Elon Musk posted over it saying, "In November of next year, we fire all politicians who betrayed the American people," which is strong. But then he goes into some of the problems with this bill. Go to the next one, because he talks about something that's extremely important that we talked about yesterday, interest payments. He said interest payments already consume 25% of all government revenue. If the massive deficit spending continues, there will only be money for interest payments and nothing else. No Social Security, no medical, no defense, nothing. And go to the next one. Geiger Capital posted on X about the significance of trillions. Geiger Capital said a million seconds ago was May 23rd. A billion seconds ago was 1993. A trillion seconds ago was 30,000 BC. The U.S. national debt is now rising by $1 trillion every 180 days. To which Elon Musk commented, "This immense level of overspending will drive America into debt slavery."
So I just wonder when a lot of people are going to begin to actually see the pattern and understand the pattern and understand the pattern is never going to change, and then throw a little bit of realism on top of it. So here's the reality. You know what the Republicans are saying about the big, beautiful bill and spending cuts? Well, we have to do this first. And Mike Johnson just said, we don't have time for a brand new bill. We worked on the bill for 14 months. You can't go back to the drawing board. We have a great product here. This is the pattern. This is what always happens. The party in power always passes a bill. They always tell you it's wonderful. And when people point to criticism that's legitimate, even from their side and their rhetoric, they say, we have to do this first. We have to pass the continuing resolution. We'll cut the budget in the next bill. We have to pass this bill so we can do it. It's the same thing over and over. Now, let's talk about raising the debt ceiling. Let me put it as bluntly as I can. And some of you are going to go, oh my God, I can't believe Jack said that. I don't give a fuck. Okay? And the reason I don't give a fuck about raising the debt ceiling is this is going to be very hard for you to freaking understand if you believe in the debt ceiling. There is no debt ceiling. It is a phantom. It is a figment of your fucking imagination. It is a bullshit thing that they roll out every so often to negotiate with. But it doesn't mean anything. They are always, 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 always going to raise the debt ceiling. When the fucking debt is $300 trillion, and it may someday be before it breaks completely, they're still going to fucking raise it. Okay? There is no debt ceiling. It's like the kid with the spoon in the Matrix. You can't bend the spoon. That's impossible. You have to see the reality. There is no spoon. You cannot stop the debt ceiling from being raised. You have to see the reality. There is no debt ceiling. They're always going to raise. What do you think they're going to do? They're going to all hold their breath, like one side will hold their breath, and then they just won't do it. And then the country will go into default. And then they'll actually say, fuck, we have to cut some things. And that's fantasy fucking land, people. That's fantasy. It's not going to happen. So when people say, but this happened, I feel like Palpatine in Star Wars. Everything is happening as I have foreseen. That's what I feel. Like, of course it happened this way. Of course it is. Now, I do want to pour a little bit of water on the fire here from Elon and Ron Paul and Dan McAdams, all three. And it's not that I disagree with the premise. It's that I also understand the reality. The people that are in government right now are not going to do the fucking cuts. I don't care if they're Republicans or Democrats. I've said before, if you put 50 Ron Paul, Thomas Massey types in the House, and you put 20 Rand Pauls in the Senate, you still can't fix this. And if you made Ron Paul president, you still can't fix this. Okay, that's the reality that's being shaped here. And to get this many scumbags, and the vast majority of people in government are scum, including many of the ones you like. I mean, I'll give Rand a half pass because he's Ron's son and he says the right thing and does the right thing sometimes. I'll give Massey a full pass. Everybody else, it's a den of thieves and robbers what's left, okay? Like, Republicans are trying to... Lindsey Graham, shut the fuck up, okay? But, you know, there are Republicans trying John Cornyn, shut the fuck up. I don't want to hear your bullshit excuses for these people. These people are fucking scumbags. Every one of them has an AIPAC minder. That's the Israel lobby. Like, literally Israel with AIPAC has a single lobbyist detailed to every congressman. That's every rep and every senator has an AIPAC minder. Okay, they can't be America First when they have a literal, attached to them like a leech up their butthole, AIPAC minder. It's not possible. And that's not anti-Jew. That's an anti-Semitic to say that. This is a foreign fucking government. I don't give a shit what their religion is. This is a foreign government that has a single individual lobbyist attached like a fucking leech to the asshole of every congressman in the United States government except one. That's Massey, because Rand Paul has his AIPAC minder, and he ain't told him to fuck off yet. That's why I only give him a half pass, even though he's Ron's son. I'm sorry. So, with all of that in mind, you're not going to get meaningful cuts to government. But you can get some of the things done that you want to get done. And I believe that's what Trump's doing here. This is not an excuse. This is a reality. Like, a lot of the things in that bill, and I went over it with you, what, 2 weeks ago or a week ago, are really good. The tax policies in the bill are really good. And understand when they say it's going to increase the deficit, that mostly it's not that it's increasing spending, it's reducing taxes, and the Democrats are calling that increasing spending. Now, let's be honest, too. The Democrats don't give a fuck about spending. They have never been a dollar they don't want to spend three times over. Give a Democrat a dollar, he'll spend four. Okay? We all know this. So when the Democrats say, we're worried about the deficit, no, you're not, because you weren't. You've never been. The only time the Democrats care about spending is when Republicans are in charge. And the only times Republicans care about spending is it's a pattern. It's the same both ways. So you're not going to get spending cuts. So the best you can do right now is evaluate what's on the table, evaluate its probability of passing in its current form, and evaluate how you can design your life to benefit from it. Any belief that you calling your senators right now will change this is fucking fantasy shit. It is. You know, I know I just invoked the ultimate adult word several times, and I'm going to invoke the Bible, and I realize the conflict there. But the truth is the truth, right? What it was St. Paul that said, when I was a child, I believed in childish things, but now as a man, I put childish things away. It is time for you to put childish things away. To stop believing that you're going to vote your way out of this or you're going to email your congressman out of this. This is going to happen. And there's a lot of really great shit coming and a lot of really bad shit coming. But what you need to do is see the good for the good. And they'd be like, Jack, you're just giving the Republicans a pass. I'm not giving anybody a pass. I don't vote. I don't play in your fake game that you think you're a player in. You're an NPC in this game. Nobody cares about you. They will just as soon drop a truck off a building on top of your head and eliminate you as too noisy of an NPC. Right? I am the weatherman. And I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. This bill will pass, mostly as it is. And the things most likely to get taken out of it are things that are probably the few things that should stay in it, like the regulations on silencers, for instance. Or, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene's like, I didn't know that it limited the ability of states to legislate AI, and I wouldn't have voted for it if I knew that. Hey, Marjorie, how about you read the fucking thing before you vote on it? All right. It was a last-minute addition. That means it was a very narrow piece of addition that you had plenty of time to figure out before you voted yes. And by the way, I don't care about that one. That, like, so, like, we're spending all this fucking money we don't have, but that's okay. But the fact that Texas or Florida can't create its own individual AI restrictions on people that live and work in their state, that's your problem? You moron, you simpleton, you idiot. I am fine with the government not being able to do shit. If you're a small government conservative like you claim, Marjorie, you should be too. But no, no. Anyway, this is the reality. If you want no tax on tips, if you want no tax on overtimes, right? If you want all the shit in that bill that's positive, then the way you get it in Washington is there has to be a litany of shit in it that you don't want. Now, you again, this isn't a pass. This isn't it's, hey, get behind it and back it. This isn't Elon's wrong. Elon's right. Elon's just not being realistic. I think that when he was sleeping on the floor, doing his Doge thing, every time he found something, he was like, whoa, I found it. Look, they have to cut this. No, they don't. No, they won't. This will not happen until the system itself breaks. And the good news or bad news, depending on how you look at it, the way they're rebooting things right now, they're probably going to kick the can 30 to 40 more years before it breaks completely. I'm just telling you, that's the way it is. Anyway, moving on. Let's hear about GPS fencing for rotational grazing from both Nicole Sauce and Ryan Steva. And I'm going to play Nicole first and Ryan right after her.
Hey, TSP. Nicole Sauce here with a question about virtual fencing for your flocks. This one came in from Tabitha, who says, what's your take on GPS virtual fencing instead of physical perimeter fencing and interior fencing for rotational grazing? Great question. She goes on to say that she recently found a company that offers this and thought it might be a better, more economical option. And I will confess that I, too, was drawn in by the siren's call of the virtual fencing advertisements that have been all over the place lately. But I'll tell you just a little bit about the process I've gone through. I don't have a true opinion on this because I have not tried them. But I will say I went down the rabbit trail on this, and these are the things I wanted to talk about. First of all, you mentioned that you think it might be more economical than putting in your own perimeter fencing and doing all the stuff with the rotational grazing with you know, stranded wire or something. Define expensive, because I think that's a very important thing to think about. For my flock, to do a GPS virtual fence would start out with $7,914 for everybody to get a collar. And for the subscription service, because they charge a subscription service per caller. And it's like $56 a year. Like, it's not exorbitant, but it adds up when your flock gets bigger and bigger and bigger. In contrast, the cost to do what we do here with the stranded wire, the chargers, the wire, the step-in posts is about $4,000 in equipment right now. I am sure we will eventually put another couple thousand in. But our startup cost was around $2,000. It's just that as your flock gets bigger and as you realize how much easier it is to have things set up in advance, you start wanting to expand what that is. The second thing I would look at, so like if you have two sheep or two goats, that's $260 a collar with a subscription fee plus a few extra fees. And that might indeed be less expensive. The next thing I'm going to want to know, though, what does training look like? And have I just traded putting in step-in posts from a time standpoint to adding flags to the ground while we train them? Or is this purely an auditory experience? You know, so like you maybe give them a visual barrier and teach them at first and then they learn it. And then also, do I need to teach them to pull back from an electric shock like you do with electric fencing, where you build a box out of cattle panels, you put the sheep inside it with the electric fence on the inside so that when they run into it and try to pull forward through it, they can't. They encounter a barrier, which teaches them to instinctually pull back. So that would be my next question, is what does training look like? And am I going to have to do that every time a new batch of livestock is born, or is it something that they'll pass on over time? That's my second question I asked as part of this thing. Three, what happens if one is simply out? Like, by which I mean, if a sheep gets out of your predefined barrier area and it's getting shocked because it's not supposed to be there, and it doesn't come back in for whatever reason. Maybe it fell down a ravine. Maybe it's super stubborn. Is it just going to get shocked to death? Or will it get to roam over time because it has a safety built in to keep that from happening? Because that sounds like a horrific way to go. Which, that then informs what happens when you have one that's, you know, getting out all the time and doesn't care about the shock and just goes for it. Does that then teach other ones to do that? Which is also a problem that can come up with your stranded wire. For how long do the collars last? As I mentioned, it's $260 for a collar plus the $56 annual subscription to connect up to, you know, their internet service. And if that only lasts a year, that's going to be reinvested every year. If it's 5 years, which I'm skeptical about because I know how long dog e-collars last, then, you know, it's, you kind of amortize that over those years and figure out what you're going to be investing in this fencing to improve it. So how long do the collars last? And then number five, what happens when GPS or the cell network goes down? Because that's what you're using to communicate with the internet about where your animal's virtual fence is. If it goes down, do they stop getting shocked? Do they all get shocked at one time? Probably not the latter, but then they're free to roam. And I know from running livestock that fencing fails sometimes. So that sounds like a catastrophic failure that's much bigger than just a section of fencing or, and no backup plan, right? No backup plan at all. So my last thing is, why isn't everybody excited about this kind of fencing? Because if this really works as it says it works, which it could, and if it lasts a really long time and is less than investing in your own fencing on your land, then it would seem to me more people would be talking with real tangible examples about how it's working. So what I decided to do personally was wait on the virtual fencing and observe what other farmers are doing with it. I will say that I was taken aback by the almost $8,000 price tag to get my sheep started with that. And I know that even if you start with a couple of sheep, you end up with more sheep over time. And even if I did use it, I would want a perimeter fence of some sort so that if failure happened, they would at least stay on the bigger piece of land. Like even if it's, you know, an electric fence that strands that are plugged into a charger, like that's probably the cheapest way to go around your perimeter is three strands of some sort of aluminum wire or another metal that you can run a current through around the perimeter so that if other internal fencing fails, they get to that, they get nailed, and then they don't get out on the road or something. Anyway, those are just my thoughts. As I said, I'm not an expert on this. I'm just telling you how I've analyzed the same question. My decision on my homestead has been not right now, but I'm going to pay attention to it. And if people start getting excited about it and I find somebody who's using it, I'm going to go see if I can invite myself into their life and see how it is. I hope you figure out what you're going to do on your homestead. I know Ryan Steva has this and is answering it from a completely different perspective. And I know what the perspective is, so I'm not going to spoiler that one. Anyway, if you want to follow me more, you can check out my podcast, livingfreeintennessee.com. And also, if you want delicious, freshly roasted coffee delivered straight to your door with an MSB discount, check it out, hollowroast.com. Make it a great week.
Hey, TSB community, this is Ryan Steva. Today, I've got a question from Tabitha. She's basically wanting to get my take on GPS virtual fencing for rotational grazing, as opposed to using a physical perimeter fence and interior fencing. And with her details, she goes on to explain that she sees there being a potential benefit in that it could really reduce time and effort being able to remotely rotate your animals without having to physically go out and do that, as well as potentially save a lot of money on fencing, because we all know fencing is quite expensive. So I took some time to do a bit of a deep dive into these systems, these GPS systems for grazing animals. And I should note up front that I have not used them. I don't know anybody who has used them. And that's because they're quite new. But I do have a fairly good grasp on animal behavior and rotational grazing. So I figured I could cover this topic and be able to give you some pros and cons. So I'm going to start there with the benefits or the pros of these systems. One big benefit is that they have the potential to significantly reduce workload, as well as reduce infrastructure, which are the two big things that Tabitha picked up on. It also has the ability, these systems have the ability to allow you to graze areas that would be really difficult to fence or prohibitively expensive to fence. A great use case I saw of this was a rent-a-goat company was using these so they could just drop their goats off for a day on a location, put on a geofence, and leave their goats there to clear the area. So that I thought was a pretty cool application for this technology. The technology also allows you to see where your animals are at all times. You can even do things like have notifications sent to your phone. But there is quite a significant list of cons. And unfortunately, because these systems are pretty new, most of the information that you can find online is very, very positive towards them because most of it is being put forth by the companies who are promoting them. So one of the big cons is that you shouldn't be using this system without a physical perimeter fence. And that's because animals can get confused quite easily, or the batteries can die, or other things can happen so that the animals may end up wandering, or if they're getting shocked because they get confused and get outside of their perimeter, now they're going to just run and run and run until the shocking stops or they get completely worn out, which might be miles away from your house. So a perimeter fence is actually still, to me, a very important part of this system. Another con is that it doesn't provide protection from predators. So if you're not putting up a physical fence as a barrier, you're removing the protection. And basically now your animals just have a collar and they're open to any potential predation. So in my opinion, that largely removes the use case for this, with the exception of daily grazing or grazing during the day in unfenced areas, to basically only being viable for cattle, because cattle should be fairly predator resistant. Another con is that it requires training of your animals. So this can become an issue, especially when you have, say, a ewe giving birth to lambs out on pasture, and those lambs now can go outside of the boundary, but the mother can't. Also, you're going to be moving the boundaries, and that can cause confusion for the animals because of a lack of a visual cue. So the animal doesn't really know where the boundary is until it hits the boundary and gets beeped at. And then it technically doesn't know whether it needs to walk forward or backward or to the side. It doesn't know where that boundary is. So yes, it can kind of figure it out, but at the same time, it can get confused and end up being shocked and run a different direction than it should. There's also the possibility of errors, both from trees, cover, shelters, GPS interruptions. Even RF interruptions can cause GPS not to work right. And so that can either shock the animal or allow them to walk out of areas that they're supposed to be, as well as forgetting to charge batteries or your batteries failing. Now, because your only means of containment is this wireless system or this collar, if the battery dies, now your animal is free to go wherever it wants. And then finally is cost. So, yeah, you could potentially save something in perimeter fencing, but there is a cost to use these systems. I used the pricing from NoFence, which is one of the few companies that actually gave transparent pricing. And so I did the calculations for a herd of 20 sheep. It would cost you $5,200 for the first year to get the collars and have a year of service, and then $900 a year after that. And that's assuming that they don't jack up the price. And then finally, who controls your data? Because the system is based on data, and that's going to the cloud somewhere, which is just somebody else's computer. So they've got your data. So, I mean, could I state it as who owns your data, as in the World Health Organization owns your data? And sure, that might be a little bit flamboyant, but they could. In theory, they could purchase it. And I've gone through some of the contracts of the companies that sell these things. And there's language like, and I quote, You grant us worldwide royalty-free license to use, store, and analyze your data. As we know, cell phone data is sold to anybody. It looks like this can be sold to anybody. And if you've got some organization, quasi-government organization or government who say wants to stop you from growing animals that might make the weather gods angry or something to that extent because of their farts, they would be able to analyze how many animals you have on how big of a space, how often you rotate them, and then they'd have access to historical data on that as well. So that definitely concerns me. Well, that's it for me. If you have any other questions or would like to get a hold of me, the way to do that is from homesteadconsultant.com. All my information is there. If you've got a homestead where you've got technical things that you want to try to implement but can't quite figure out how to, that's kind of my specialty, and I would love to help you out or talk with you about potentially helping you out there. And remember, everybody, until next week, go get your hands dirty.
Okay, I think they both did a great job on that. I really don't have anything to add, so let's move on to what's known as the universal edibility test. If you were to take any sort of multi-day in-depth wilderness survival training, you would learn this test, and it is definitely useful for that, but it has some other usages as well. Let's listen to Carrie Brown right now talk about it and see what he has to say, and maybe I'll have an adder. I don't know, because again, I haven't heard this one yet.
Hey, TSP community. Carrie Brown here from Strong Roots Resources, and we're in the middle of May, actually getting towards the end of May, and here in the Southeast, when I get asked what can we forage right now, the answer is darn near everything. So, in lieu of giving you an exceptionally long list of things to go foraging for, many of which are kind of readily obvious at this stage, I wanted to get into a few details, a few observations about foraging safely and wisely, especially as we're in that time of year when people who are new to this are very motivated and are very excited about building out their foraging skill set. So first of all, I want to cover the universal edibility test. This is a relatively sensible method to determine whether something that you are foraging is safe to consume. Keeping in mind that this is kind of situated more for survival scenarios and not so much, you know, day-to-day learning. And it does not take into account certain plants or other species that could result in a cumulative toxicity effect. This is kind of to assess if something is going to mess you up very quickly. So this is kind of the 101 on this, and I highly suggest that you dig into this a little bit further as you are building out your foraging skill set. So first of all, you want to separate and identify the part of the plant that you believe to be the edible portion. So if you're testing a berry, we're working with a berry. If you're testing a leaf, we're working only with the leaf. So only with that one part, because it can depend. In some cases, one part is edible and one part is inedible or even toxic. Not unlike potatoes and tomatoes. So we're only going to test one part of this plant at a time. One part of one plant, preferably the same plant from the same site, and there's going to be 8-hour gaps between moving from one test to the next. So after you've identified what you believe to be the portion that is to be consumed, you're going to crush it or kind of break it apart and smell it. If you smell anything that smells strongly of almonds, that can be an indicator of the presence of cyanide. If you smell anything that smells soapy or like a rancid oil or just really anything that is especially foul and unappealing to the senses, we're not going to proceed any further in this case for this field test. And we're going to go ahead and assume that that plant is not a friend. After an 8-hour period, after your initial smell test, we're going to do a skin contact test. You will take a small piece of that part of the plant and rub it on the inside of your elbow or your wrist for a few minutes. So not just briefly, but you need to get this, really get this into contact with your skin. But just do this at one site. And then you'll want to wait about 8 hours for any rash, burning, or any other kind of reaction. We go for the inside of the arm like that because if you've ever broken out in poison ivy or something similar, your skin is fairly thin right there, but it's also very vascular, so your body's apt to have a rapid response. So this will give you some feedback relatively soon. If you have performed that test and 8 hours have passed and you have had no reaction, you can now do a lip and mouth contact test. So you want to touch a small piece to your lips, or even kind of like the inside of your lip, for about 3 minutes. You want to watch for any tingling, numbing, burning sensation, anything that should set off any alarms. If you have no reaction at that point, you can put a small piece of that in your mouth, chew it for 15 minutes, move it around in your mouth, but you're not going to actually consume it at this time. If you experience any irritation, go ahead and spit it out and halt your test at that point. Furthermore, if there is no reaction, you may swallow a very small amount, and then you need to wait 8 hours again. Here's what's hard and here's what's important, and that's why I said this is specific to survival scenarios. You don't eat anything else in that time because you need to be able to figure out what, if anything, you've had the reaction to. If you complete that 8-hour timeline with no ill effects, you can eat a slightly larger portion, wait another 8 hours, and then at that point you may consume a full portion. And you can assume at that point that whatever you're working with is safe to eat in moderation. Like I said, keeping in mind that there are certain things that are, you know, a lot of our sour flavors, like in sheep sorrel, you have a lot of oxalates, and that kind of sour lemony taste is kind of an indicator of that, and consuming large quantities of something like that can have some ill effects, particularly on kidneys and other organs kind of that are dedicated to cleansing the blood. So that is the universal edibility test in a nutshell. It is well worth reading up on this from multiple sources. You really probably can't go wrong with the way they teach it in survival school for various branches of the military. Keeping in mind, you're only testing one part at a time, one plant at a time. Some things are toxic that are raw, but they're edible when cooked, which is the case for a whole lot of different kinds of root specimens. Never eat things that you can't identify, definitely in non-survival situations. So don't, you know, err on the side of caution. I want to urge people to err on the side of caution without being fearful either. Most of this is really just common sense. And just watch out for any kind of cumulative toxicity buildup. A couple of other things that I like to encourage folks to watch for when we're actually out in the field together is really take in the big picture. You know, this time of year, everything is out. Everything, plant-wise, everything is out. So I might be in a spot where I'm looking at some of the black raspberries that are ripe, but what is also readily, hanging around is both, you know, poison ivy and poison oak. Poison hemlock seems to really be in the public consciousness right now, so keep an eye out for that. That can be a lookalike for various kinds of wild carrot. So don't just hone in on whatever has captured your attention. Really take in the whole picture. It's snake season, the yellow jacket ground nest, the hornets and all that kind of stuff. And so it's real easy if you are very excited and very motivated and into it and you're looking at your app and you're looking at your book and you're looking at the plant to, perhaps overlook certain things that can kind of make your day less than enjoyable. So, you know, take these things into consideration, but have a good time. You know, have a curious mindset. Enjoy the learning process. Share it with other people, and you'll get there. You'll get there. I'm only reasonably good at this point because it's something that I'm a little bit obsessed with, and I am constantly observing and interacting and asking myself, hey, what's that? I wonder what we can use that for. So if you cultivate that curious mindset, that'll get you a long ways down the road on all of this. So thank you so much for listening, you guys. If you can, if you wanted to reach out to me for any of my services, any of my design consulting on your landscape, everything from a regenerative and permaculture and ecologically minded approach, give me a holler. Reach out to me at strongrootsresources@gmail.com. We've got foraging classes coming up on June 14th here in Knoxville, Tennessee. If you're in the area and you'd like to come out, give me a shout. I'll get you on the list. And we'll talk to you guys next time.
All right, I think that was plenty comprehensive, so let's move on. And Ken Daniels, our chef on the Expert Council, has been doing a series for us that all started with someone coming upon a bag full of awesome differential seafoods and saying, hey, can I put this all together into some sort of a soup or a stew? And this is a very common thing throughout the world. Ken did a deep dive for you on three different versions, but there are more. There's one, I can't remember the proper name for it, but it is more of an El Salvadoran version of bouillabaisse, which is, you know, bouillabaisse is from southern France, and Ken did that as the first one. And then he did Chopino last week in California. And today he has something for you that is called moqueca, which is a Brazilian version of this type of thing. This is, again, incredibly common throughout the world. Seafood has been eaten for as long as people figured out, hey, you can eat this stuff. And whether it's freshwater or saltwater, okay, seafood, obviously saltwater, but whether fresh or saltwater, humans have consistently built settlements on water, right? Whether it's the ocean, rivers, inlets, deltas, lakes. And it's because when you do that, you have access to food. I guarantee you, where there is water, there is life. Where there is life, there's life you can consume. So this is incredibly universal, and it's something that we all tend to find that we have access to. And the more ways we learn to put it together, the more different ways we can enjoy it. So with that, I give you Chef Ken Daniels.
Hello all, Chef Ken here, wrapping up our summer seafood soup series with one final stop. We've been to France for bouillabaisse, we've hit up San Francisco for Chopino, and now we're headed south, way south, down to Brazil. Today we're talking about moqueca, a coconut milk-based seafood stew that's bright, rich, herbaceous, and something that manages to feel both tropical and deeply comforting. It's not just delicious, it's easy to make, flexible, naturally low-carb, and basically just sunshine in a damn bowl. So let's get into it. So what is moqueca? Moqueca is a Brazilian seafood stew that comes in a couple of different regional styles, most famously from Bahia or Bahia in the Northeast. The Bahian version is what we're doing today. So it's fish, tomatoes, peppers, onions, garlic, lime, cilantro, and coconut milk, all simmered gently in dende oil or a rich fat of your choice. So if you've never heard of dende oil, it's red palm oil. It's bold, deep, almost smoky. But I get it. It's not on every pantry shelf, but you can absolutely use tallow, duck fat, or even just olive oil with a bit of butter to round it out. But you should seek out this dende oil for your pantry. It's the heart and soul to this dish and incredibly important to Brazilian cuisine and the capoeira philosophy. The flavor of moqueca is unmistakable. It's savory, citrusy, just with a whisper of heat and a luscious coconut richness that pulls everything together. Here's why I love moqueca, especially in the summertime. It's light, and even though it's a stew, it does not weigh you down. It's forgiving. You can add frozen fish, frozen shrimp. You could even add in some leftover grilled seafood. And it holds beautifully. Like Chopino, I'll make the base, portion it, and freeze it. Come winter, I'll just add some fresh seafood and gently heat. And you know what? This dish screams vacation. But it's made in one pot with easy-to-find ingredients. So here's how I build my base. I start by sweating sliced onions, garlic, and bell peppers, red or yellow. And you put it in your fat of choice. I like tallow or duck fat for richness. But coconut oil works too if you want want to lean it into that tropical vibe. Keep it low and slow. You want to soften, not sear. You're building the sweetness from the peppers and aromatic. Now add plenty of chopped tomato. Yes, you can use canned if you want, but I like fresh when they're ripe. In the summertime, we're looking at good fresh tomatoes. The tomatoes will help break down and become the body of the stew. Next up, I add the lime juice, zest, salt, and if you just like a little bit of kick, add a little bit of fresh chili or red pepper flake. You're looking for not spicy, just to kind of give it a punch. Finally, I add the coconut milk, full fat, the good stuff, and stir in a handful of chopped cilantro stems. Yep, the stems. Take the stems, tie them together with some kitchen twine. It just makes it easier to pull out later. More flavor, and save the leaves for garnish for later. Let this simmer for about 15 to 20 minutes uncovered. You're building a deep broth here. So if you've listened before, another chef tip, this is also where I'll add a bit of fish sauce or just a spoonful of anchovy paste. No one's going to notice, but they'll definitely taste the difference. So what seafood do I use? Man, I keep it simple. You use what you've got or what's frozen. Whitefish like snapper, cod, tilapia, yes. Catfish and bass are also great choices. Shrimp, always. I even do crawfish this time of year. Scallops, calamari, mussels, or even crab, totally fair game. Anything really goes in this. But whatever you choose, moqueca is about poaching the seafood in that broth you just built. It should feel gentle, like hot broth bath for the fish. Lay the fish in, add shrimp and other delicate stuff on top, and let it simmer just until cooked, about 5 to 8 minutes total, tops. Okay, so once your seafood is perfectly poached, finish with a big handful of chopped fresh cilantro. I add a drizzle of olive oil or a tiny spoon of dende oil, and you've got it. There's this deep funk that dende oil brings to the dish. For me, it completes the dish and honors the Brazilian culture. Add a pinch of smoked paprika or extra lime zest right on top. Serve it in wide bowls. Traditionally, it's paired with white rice and a Portuguese hot sauce called molho de pimenta. And if you're a low carb, just skip the rice. You really won't miss it. But if you really want to impress, add a side of grilled okra. Or if you've been listening here, this would be a great time for grilled hen of the woods mushrooms. But you've got tons of options. Side note, I've been playing around with a ton of mushrooms lately. Expect a series on this in the near future. So, moqueca is one of those dishes that checks all the boxes. Simple, healthy, stunning, and flavor, and endlessly riffable. You can make it spicy, mild, rich, or light. You can batch the base, freeze it, or just poach seafood as needed. So I put this series together because these soups, bouillabaisse, chipino, and moqueca, aren't just recipes. They're examples of how real people in fishing communities around the world use what they had to create something lasting. And for us homesteaders, that matters. These dishes teach us how to use the whole harvest, preserve the best parts, and stretch flavor through technique, not expensive ingredients. Making a good soup base in the summer and freezing it for winter isn't just smart, it's tradition. And learning from other cultures helps us get better at our own craft. Hey, so keep those questions coming in. Check out all kinds of recipes and articles at my websites, bloodsugarchef.com and drinkeatlearn.com. Until next time, this is Ken, the Blood Sugar Chef. Cheers.
And now I'm hungry. Anyway, speaking of being hungry, sometimes when you're hungry, you might decide you want food, you don't want to cook it, like you just heard about how to do. And sometimes you might pay for an expensive cab ride for your food. Or you can provide the expensive cab ride for somebody else's food. And there's other things that you might do with your vehicle that are business-oriented. And most people, when they get their car insurance, their liability insurance, they buy what the government says they have to, and they insure their property for what it's worth. That's just what they do. And when people say, well, what is your vehicle for? Then you answer that question, and it's not specifically for business. Then are you using it for business? And then if something happens, well, what next? With that in mind, let's hear about selecting the right type of insurance for your needs from Matt Sersley.
Hey, TSP crew, this is Matthew Sersley with AgristTaxAdvice.com, here to talk with you about insurance. Yeah, I know. I normally talk about tax stuff, but I am a lawyer and I was a personal injury attorney for 15 years, suing insurance companies and defending insurance companies. Very, very, very rarely on that last part. But was reminded recently of how not having the right liability insurance can really make for a bad day. Now, every state is different. Some states have what's called no-fault insurance. Most states don't. Even in the no-fault insurance states, there can be times when you're at fault. But I want to just discuss a couple of things. First of all, make sure your limits are high enough. When you buy insurance, it's not ever an unlimited insurance policy. In Texas, you can buy as little as $30,000 of insurance for an injured person and $25,000 of property damage. You know, those numbers maybe made some sense, 20 years ago when that was what the numbers were passed in that law. Today, they don't. New cars are regularly costing $50,000, $60,000, $100,000. You don't want your insurance company to cut a check for $25,000 and say, hey, you're on the hook for the rest of this. Similarly, when I started practicing personal injury, it was pretty rare that I had clients with $30,000 in medical bills. But with inflation, it's pretty common. And again, you don't want to get stuck where you owe money personally because you caused an accident or something. And by the way, this advice applies to all liability insurance. So most of my examples and experience are car wrecks, but it does apply to homeowners too, and it can apply to business insurance. You know, only you know how much is enough coverage, but personally, I think anything less than $100,000 in property damage coverage is probably a bad idea. And really $200,000 to $300,000 in liability coverage these days, more if you have some significant assets. And this shouldn't cost you much money. Like, buying the insurance at the base level is what's really expensive. You know, I checked myself going from $30,000 to $500,000 on my policy was something like $12 a month difference. So this is not an expensive thing to add, because still most of the time that $30,000 will be enough. But on those rainy days, man, you'll want some more. The next thing is make sure you have uninsured coverage and underinsured coverage. And sometimes you only have one. Texas, they used to be, if you had one, you had the other. But in the past couple of years, that's not been the case. And I've seen several cases where people had uninsured coverage, but not underinsured coverage. So uninsured coverage covers you if the other person has no insurance. Underinsured coverage covers you if the other person doesn't have enough insurance. You know, again, let's say you're in a car wreck and you've got $50,000 in medical bills and that other driver was irresponsible and only had $30,000 in coverage. Well, yeah, you can go after them for the rest, but for $20,000, if they don't have it, it's not going to be worth it. That's where your underinsured coverage will come in, and it will pick up the difference. Now, in some states, it stacks, so yours is added on top of theirs. In most states, it's a different limit. So, like, let's say they have $30,000, you have $50,000, your coverage will pay $20,000 over their $30,000. Again, most of the expense in this is getting the coverage in the first place. Once you have it, raising the limits is usually pretty cheap. You generally can't buy more coverage for uninsured coverage than you have in liability. And I can't think of any circumstance where I would not max out the uninsured and underinsured coverage, unless for some reason there was something where it was super, super expensive. And again, usually what buying it is expensive, but raising the limits is not. The next thing is look into whether you have either personal injury protection, sometimes called PIP, or MedPay. Some states like Texas allow you to buy both. These function differently in every state, but what the great thing about these is these pay for medical bills in a no-fault insurance way. So let's say you caused the car accident and you need some medical care. This will still pay for your medical care. And in some states, some types of coverage may also pay for lost wages. That can also be great even if you're not at fault, because normally with a personal injury suit, you get paid everything all at once. So you've got to wait till you're done treating, done going to the doctor, etc., before you get paid for your lost wages and your medical bills. At least in Texas, with personal injury protection, you can submit your pay stubs every 2 weeks to your PIP carrier, and they will pay you, I think it's usually 75% of your normal wages. So that way you're not falling behind. This is a very common thing when people get injured. You know, they're not working either, or they don't have a car, so they're off work. And now they have no income coming in as they have all these additional expenses, and this can be a lifesaver. Now, this coverage is more expensive because it is no fault, and usually the limits are very low, $2,500, $5,000, or $10,000. If you can't afford this, this could be an area where it makes sense to not get it. But again, get the quote, and once you get the quote, see how much you could buy, compare that cost to the lower cost amount. I'll tell you, I have been in car wrecks that I've caused, and I don't think I've ever not hit the $10,000 cap when I was injured in a car wreck. The ER bill alone can very easily be $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, and then some physical therapy or whatever. It adds up really quickly. The last thing you need to make sure about is umbrella coverage. Not everybody needs umbrella coverage, but if you have any assets other than a house and a car, you probably want umbrella coverage. Umbrella coverage is it's an umbrella over the rest of your coverage. It's added on to usually your homeowners and your auto. It's usually $1 million or $2 million, and it's usually insanely cheap because it only ends up paying if the liability limits you have are exceeded. I'll tell you, I have sued people. I have recovered far more than what their liability coverage was. And they had businesses, and I would have taken their business for my clients. And they had umbrella coverage. That umbrella coverage stepped in and basically made everybody had a better day. Because I didn't really want their company. I wanted the money for my clients. And they wanted to keep their company. And because they had the right coverage, they did. Again, this is insanely cheap coverage usually. I think my $2 million policy is like $17 a month. So if you ever come close to using it once just for the peace of mind, it easily pays for itself. Now, a quick warning about one big problem with insurance. Well, two. You need to watch out for exclusions in coverage. The first exclusion, and this is something most people don't know about, it's a newer thing, but a lot of the time your regular auto insurance policy has an exclusion for when you are doing any sort of DoorDash or Uber or anything like that. Now, you can add on an extra thing and it will cover you for doing that, but otherwise your insurance doesn't apply. Now, Uber or DoorDash or whatever, they provide liability coverage. So if you cause a car wreck, you'll be covered for the damages you caused to other people. But your comp, your collision, your rental coverage, your PIP, your UM/UIM, none of those will apply if you don't make sure they apply when you're doing these things. And again, I've worked cases where people were driving DoorDash. Somebody else ran a red light, hit them. They were really badly hurt. We went to make the claim on their, you know, underinsured coverage when the liability coverage wasn't enough. And, oh, sorry, no coverage because they were doing DoorDash. And typically the lack of coverage begins when you turn the app on. So you don't have to be doing an actual ride for your insurance coverage to be gone. Like if the app is on and you are driving the car, you probably have no coverage. I've seen at least one policy that if any person in the car has the app on, there is no coverage. And that's because sometimes I've seen boyfriends or girlfriends where, you know, one is driving, the other's door dashing, and then there is coverage. So the insurance companies are, you know, getting rid of that loophole. The other thing to watch out for is people who live with you who are not on your coverage. And where this really tends to come up with is college and apartment roommates. Usually, if somebody borrows your car with your permission, they are covered under your policy. But there's usually an exclusion for if anybody lives with you and borrows your car and they're not on the policy. And that's because let's say you live with a guy who has four DWIs and can't buy insurance. They don't want you to buy a car, well, him to buy a car, give you the money to buy the car. You buy it, you insure it, and now he's driving it. And now they're insuring this very dangerous driver and not charging enough premiums. But I've seen it come up a lot where, you know, a college roommate borrows the other college roommate's car. With permission, causes a car wreck, sorry, no coverage applies, no comp, no collision, no liability. Now, if they have their own insurance, it would apply at least to the liability, but maybe not to the others. The other time this comes up a lot is with kids. Your 15-year-old who lives with you borrows the car, doesn't have a driver's license. They may not be covered when they, you know, borrow that car. Now, they probably did it without your permission, so there'd also be no coverage there. But let's say you let them drive the car. You know, you're teaching them how to drive. Yeah, they don't have a license yet, but you're teaching them. If they're not on your insurance, they probably are not covered if they do something. And again, I've seen this a lot with especially teenage, you know, or young adult roommates. Oh, hey, my car's in the shop. Can I borrow your car to go do something? Well, if they're not on your insurance and something happens, you're probably not covered. Again, I'm an attorney. I've seen a lot of this happen on people in their worst days. Just want everybody out there to make sure you are covered. And the final piece of advice is check this every 3 to 4 years. Make sure that you are have the right coverage and that your situation hasn't changed. You know, maybe right now it makes sense to have $100,000 in liability coverage. But, oh, hey, now I have a business that's doing, you know, $200,000 a year. I probably want to up that to $500,000 or $1 million in coverage. I'd love to help anybody who wants to talk about this. Please send me an email. Contact me at agristaxadvice.com. And my email is there, and I'm glad to talk about this. I may not be able to help you if you're not in the state of Texas because I may not understand your law, but I can at least hopefully help you understand what's going on elsewhere. This is advice I hope you never, ever need to use because you never have a liability claim, but statistically, most people do at some point, so you want to get it right. Have a great day.
My only addition to this is going to be that, like, there's a very famous saying in the world of preparedness, better to have something and not need it than need it and not have it. And that's something that's true and not true in insurance at the same time. It's both true and false. And here's what I mean. If you have insurance to protect you in the instance that you harm someone else, you harm yourself, someone else harms you, anything like that, or you damage somebody else's property and it's in excess of what you need, that's good. Because you never know when it will be not in excess of what you need. You don't know how much damage can happen, right? When it comes to insuring your property, the one thing I'll say is make sure you're not over-insuring your property. And make sure that, for instance, if you carry more insurance than the value of your property, the type of insurance you have will actually still pay out based on replacement cost of what you're trying to replace. And here's why. If, for instance, you are insuring a vehicle and the market value of that vehicle, if it were totaled, is $25,000, and you have $50,000 worth of insurance on it, and it in fact is totaled, the insurance company is going to cut you a check for the value of the vehicle. Unless you have something specifically, and you need to talk to your insurance agent about this, because as Matt said, this varies by state, that says must be replaced, you know, like a replacement value type rider or something like that. I have had many times on my insurance, you know, you get 3 years into a car, and you look at the value of the car, and you look at the value of the car as it's insured. And this is, again, not insuring the other side of the equation, because I don't know what your car's worth, and if it's my fault, that type of thing, or what the cost of a medical bill is. But I can put an app, like some things you can't put a price on. Right? You can't say, I know it'll cost this much. But one thing you can put a price on is the market value of a vehicle. And I've seen that happen to people. So I've had conversations with my insurance agent, like, if this vehicle's totaled, what is the maximum amount you're going to give me on it? Okay, then why am I insuring it for $10,000 more? Just make sure you don't fall into that ant lion trap, right? Because they'll tell you, oh, it's great, because then, yeah, but are you going to get, will I actually get the money if this happens? If the answer is no, then you're overpaying for that portion of your insurance. All right, moving on. Let's talk about becoming a recognized expert or becoming an expert for your own benefit, because I think that'll make it more universal. And some of you might, because you listen now, because you thought of it that way, I wouldn't mind being an expert even if I don't care about being known for it. You might listen. You might actually decide you might want to be known for it, because I'll explain how this all wraps up into my second book, which I'm working on right now. So as I was working on Laws of Life 2, which I'm not sure that's the title for it yet, right? But I'm working on chapter 2 right now, and it's the concept that everybody is an expert in a few things. And that the best thing you can do for yourself is determine what those are and, you know, maximize and use those in your life, depending on how you want to do that. Well, as I was writing this morning and thinking about that, what came back to me was a book that I probably am one of the only people that was an owner in a company at the time this book was released that literally bought copies and gave it to employees that worked for me that I wrote a paycheck for every week. Because if you know what the book's about, you can realize that that might mean that that really good employee will end up going off and doing something on their own, or that they're going to start outsourcing some of the work you pay them to do to somebody else. I had a problem with neither of those things. I always looked at it as my job as an employer was to get the most out of you I could while you were there, and to give you such an opportunity that you would either choose to stay, or if you went somewhere else, you took something with you. I'm okay with that. That's part of the employee-employer relationship as far as I'm concerned. But in that book, there was a chapter on becoming an expert. And basically, Ferris said you can become a recognized, not just an expert, but a recognized expert in anything in about 90 days. And here is his basic formula. And I'm just giving you straight bullet points. This is like the what is it, 6-8-point formula to do this. One, read the top 3 books in your niche. Two, summarize and synthesize their content so that you can explain them and understand them. join 2 to 3 trade associations so that you can say I'm a member of blah, blah, and blah. Create your own title or certification, like come up with how do you recognize yourself, right? Well, how do you put yourself forward? Speaker, author, consultant, whatever, expert in, I don't know, freaking dance and movement or whatever. And, you know, you can then seek certifications in that niche as well. So you can say, I'm certified in blah, 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 and this is what I do, right? Write articles for trade publications and get at least a couple published. Then seek to get quoted in the media. Get somebody else to quote something you said. And there's ways, we won't get into that right now, right? But get quoted in the media so you can say, as seen as, you know, in the New York Times. Or, you know, for me, I might say, as seen or as quoted in the Dallas Morning News, right? The Houston Chronicle, the Mike and Mike Radio Show, the Glenn Beck Show, the Judge Napolitano Show. Like, I can say all of that now, right? So get something like that done. Then offer to speak at local events using everything I just said to sell yourself as a speaker. And when you do that, then you add that to kind of your one pager about yourself. And as you do that, try to go higher level events, build a speaker CV, and build a basic website for credibility. And again, this was all written, I think the book was released in 07 or 08, which means it was probably written in 05, 06 time frame that Ferris was writing the book. And therefore, a basic website was fine at the time because it wasn't that hard to put up a website, but you could not do what you can do now and move as quickly as you can. So what I wanted to do is update this to the 2025 version, utilizing all the things that we either didn't have or didn't have to the developed level that we do today, but keeping Tim's core. And again, I'm going to blow through this pretty quick today as a segment, but I could take the same outline. And I could honestly, with just the outline that I have in front of me right now, which is just a series of bullet points, present on this for 2 hours. And if there's interest, I may do an episode, probably not next week, but maybe the week after or the week after that, where we go deep dive into this subject. So let me know if you want more on this. So in our time now, right, we have audiobooks. Like, there were audiobooks back then, but we didn't have Audible, you know, and Audible credits that you probably get for free on Amazon for other shit you do, where you get the books almost for free or what have you. So I would say in your 3 books, speed that up by using 3 to 5 audiobooks and use AI for notes and highlights about those books even after you've read them. AI probably has knowledge of the books that you've read or listened to, right? And then summarize more sources with AI. Find other books you don't have time to read. Ask AI to develop you content based like a Cliff Notes version of those books and things like that. Feed that information into products like ChatGPT for summaries back, but also feed it into free tools like Notebook LM, which is made by Google, and you can feed it information. You can find ebooks that are in PDF, drop that in, interviews with authors, etc. Drop all of that into Notebook LM and have it develop podcasts for you to listen to. Basically, it uses 2 AI-generated voices, a man and a female voice, and they discuss whatever content you feed it in. So get that to happen. Then use AI to create quizzes to lock your knowledge in. Notebook LM can do that for you. You can build you study guides. ChatGPT does a really good job of it if you give it the right instructions. So not only should you do what Tim said, which is read the books so that you can summarize and talk about them, but actually have this new tool we have quiz you on it. Have it give you 50 multiple choice question quizzes and things like that. Then coin your own method or framework. Like, use AI to develop your own brand, your name, your brand, your position, so that you can actually start to formulate things, because this is what we're going to go next into building a website. The problem with building a website is most people start with, I just want to build a website. What you need to do is work out the framework first. How do you want to position yourself? What do you want to call yourself? You know, I'm calling myself Jack Spirico, but beyond calling yourself Jack Spirico, I refer to myself speaker, author, consultant, because I've done those things. I want to take the word consultant off because I don't want to do it anymore, but it still sells well, right? Podcaster, author, speaker, right? Somehow you have, and threes, remember always the rule of threes. Threes are the most powerful way to list descriptions, benefits, features, I don't care what it is, because the human mind loves balance. when you hear two things, you want a third one in your mind, and a fourth one, you begin to start, like, okay, it's too many, and your mind starts shifting. I'm trying to figure out which gun I want to buy, and this guy's giving me four bullet points instead of three. I'm kind of out. So the rule of threes is incredibly powerful, and it's been used so many times. I use it in my branding when I used to do branding for people. You know, Syrian Optimization Services was one of the companies that I owned or co-owned a part of with Neil Franklin. And when I developed the marketing for that, we summed up everything the company did with analyze, apply, achieve. And I could present the entire company off those three things. And when you spoke to a customer, a prospect, whatever, and you gave them analyze, apply, and achieve, they could already begin to form an understanding. And when somebody already begins to form an understanding, then it's really easy to educate them. Because you've given them an understanding, you've primed the pump before you start asking for water out of the well. So you want to definitely do that. You want to coin your method and framework. Develop your name, your brand, your position, then build your pro website. Make it look professional. Pay somebody a little bit of money to do some graphics. You do all the content, right? You can auto-generate logos, copy, lead magnets. Those of you that are about to start taking the course with me and Tom, starting Monday, you're going to learn how to do all of that, but you can do it on your own. We just put it in a framework that makes it faster and quicker to learn. And then you want to take niche, like this is like an icing on the cake thing. Not everybody's going to do this, but if you're going to build a professional website, one of the things that you can do today really, really quickly without having to have somebody that knows PHP and MySQL and app development and all, you can use AI to develop web apps, whether they're just direct interfaces that people use on your website or whether you actually market them, even if they're free, as something that, hey, you can make an instruction sheet for them, like get this app, and then it sends an email. Here's how you get your app that you paid for or you just said you wanted. That's a great way to get somebody's email address. And put it on your phone. So you don't have to be in the Google Play Store. You don't have to be in the Apple App Store. You don't have to do any of that to have a web app. Basically, it's just browser-based, and they put a specific URL, and then you put it on your phone home screen. And anytime they want to use your app, they just push that button, and it's right there in front of them. It's like a shortcut to a page on your website. But you've developed intelligence into it to do something in your niche. If you were in the silver industry, you might develop a tool that lets them get quick pricing on different coins. If you were in diet and nutrition, you might develop a meal plan app, right? If you were in preparedness, you might develop an app that helps people develop an inventory of the products they have stored. Like, you figure that out for yourself. That's a nice piece of icing on the cake. Somebody comes to your website and has tools like that available, you're at another level than someone that just has a WordPress blog, right? Join online and real-world associations. So just like Ferris said, join trade organizations and stuff like that. Find like online and real-world organizations in your niche and join them. If I were in health and nutrition and I was going the primal paleo route, I would join places like the Price-Pottinger Association, which I am a member of, and the Weston A. Price Association, which I am not, because I do not like Sally Fallon at all. I'm sorry. But if I were in that realm, I might do it anyway because it's good branding, right? Because we're trying to establish expertise here. And so by saying I'm part of these organizations, this is my site, this is what I do, this is the value that I have to offer, etc., is incredibly powerful in projecting an image to society. Then write authority articles. Write authority articles, and you can use AI to help with this. I don't like saying, hey, write me an article. I like basically collaborating with AI to actually write content that sounds like me. Again, in our course, we're going to teach you how to do this, but the speed at which you can move with research and tailoring an article to a thing is night and day from where it was 10 years ago, let alone 20 years ago. I can come up and I can spit out articles that are mostly written by me, but the actual typing is done by GPT. Basically, I tell it everything I want, format it, ask it questions, figure out how to add the things and it comes up with that I would have never thought of, train it to write in my voice and have it spit something out, and then edit it. And that is way faster than just doing it yourself and with way better results, and it still sounds like you wrote it because you did. Again, there's certain techniques that we're going to give away in the course on how to do this for the 100 that got in. We will be rebooting and redoing that course, you know, several times a year for those that didn't get in. but you want to write those authority articles. You want to publish anything you can't get published somewhere else on your site on the blog. And you should be turning out at least an article a week that way, because you can do it in 15 minutes once you get good at it. It'll probably take you 2 hours the first time you do it, and 15 minutes like the fifth time you do it. But you want to try to get those articles published in other people's magazines. You want to try to get those articles published in other people's websites so that you can cite that as part of your authority as an expert. Okay? And remember, you actually have the expertise because we started out with developing them, the knowledge set to be able to apply them. Because if you're going to be an expert, you should be going beyond reading books about them. This is just establishing a knowledge base. In all of this, you should be continuing your learning nonstop. That's kind of unsaid for now. But then, you know, the next best thing to do would be to write a book. Write a book and self-publish it. Use Amazon KDP or some other platform. KDP, after using it myself, I would say if you get a little help with your graphics design and your typesetting, it is fan-freaking-tastic. You don't have to hit the bestsellers list like I do. If you do, great. Right? You don't have to necessarily do that, though. The fact that you have the book, you can point to the book. Maybe write a couple books. Maybe write a series of books. Now, when you're speaking, you also have something to sell, but you also have the credibility that being an author brings to the table. So you're published in multiple formats. That is one of the defining characteristics that we have in our mind as an expert. Okay? And then, and you, some of this can be concurrent. Start a podcast or a YouTube channel. AI can assist you with editing, titling, summaries. I use AI almost every day in show planning now. And the reason I can say that and you guys don't immediately reflexively go, ew, is because you know I did the show starting off in my car with index cards, and I've done it for 17 years. I'm not turning it over. I'm using my skill set plus leverage. That's what you should do, because then it will be real. It will be you. I am sick of YouTube videos already that are like, the 10 superfoods you need to eat, and that announcer voice thing that comes from AI that everybody, that's in like 100 different videos by 100 different people now. It should still be you, but you can use it to speed up the production. So now when somebody comes to your website, you have books that you've published, articles that you publish yourself, articles you've been elsewhere, you've spoken at events, etc., right? Because we're going to get to that next. You have a YouTube channel, you have a podcast. All of a sudden, you're starting to look like an authority. And the more professional it looks, the more of an authority you look like, even if you're new, right? Then you want to speak at in-person events and meetups. So you want to offer, you know, you start off, offer to do free talks. Like people now go, can you come speak at this? Like, that's going to be $6,000 out the door minimum, and probably not, because I don't think you have the money. And then you don't, okay. And like, but when I was new to this space, I spoke at everything that I could possibly do. Right? And you should too. And the local stuff that doesn't require travel is a really great way. Like the best first couple speaking gigs for you to do are going to be ones that nobody's really going to know about or remember unless you tell them about it. Because you're not going to be great the first time you do it. And even if you've done it before and you're okay, if you're speaking on something new, it will take a while to develop your formula that makes you you and a great speaker. Right, so by doing some little ones first, then you can get, you say, I spoke at this, this, and this, and I can get a little bit bigger one. You start to get some that you can actually put up on your site. Whenever you speak, have somebody sit in the audience that likes you, point a phone at you on a tripod with a cheap mount, get a $50 remote microphone, and have it videoed, even if they're videoing it, and say they'll give you a copy. Video it yourself, you have it immediately, you start working with it. Take every talk you do, go through it, pick out 4 or 5 segments that are 1 or 2 minutes long, that are fire, that were the best you did, even if it wasn't all great, the best of what you have, pair it together into a clip set, put that on your site, put it on your YouTube channel. When you go to get a speaking engagement at the next place, include that. The whole thing should be no more than 4 minutes long. Nobody's going to sit and watch your 2-hour speech to see if they want to give you one as well. They want to know like what you do really well. They want that interaction with the audience. Anything where you get an applause or you see people really perk up when you say it, make a note to yourself while you're talking that it happened about this time. And then when you go back, you know where to find it. Use that. It's very, very powerful. And additionally, you need to be pitching media, like old school media, but definitely podcasts, virtual events, things like that. And you can have, like, to do this, you can have AI develop email exploratory initial emails to sell yourself. have it develop a one pager for you and things like that. You put that together, and I promise you, you could take a subject you know nothing about right now, and if you know nothing about it, but you really find it interesting and you have passion for it, 90 days might be a little bit too aggressive. I mean, remember, Tim's 90-day formula was really designed for a person that kind of already knew the thing to a degree and then wanted to go from like a guy that's interested in it, knows about it, can talk about it, to a recognized expert in 3 months. 4 months, 5 months from zero, you probably can do that today. When Tim wrote the formula, I would say if you knew nothing, that whole formula might have took you more like a year. So we've gone from you can do it 90 days knowing something to you can do it in 120 days to 180 days knowing nothing. Which means if you do know something and you get moving quickly and you have some stuff already in place, like a website or whatever, you can probably establish yourself as an expert in a given niche in about 60 days. And it's 2025 and you're not doing this, and what is wrong with you? Now, I know some of you are like, Jack, I don't want your life. I get it. I understand it. Take and realize, like, the first half of that formula mostly, you can just develop expertise in anything you want now. And then you decide if you want recognition, if you want opportunity that goes along with it. But let me sum up why it's going in the book. Okay? I've already got this written into this chapter. Most people spend the majority of their life doing things they hate. And even if they don't hate it at first, they grow to hate it. If you ask somebody when they get a job, do you like your job? They say, yeah, it's pretty good. But they don't have passion for the actual things they do. Odds are in 6 months to 3 years, when you say, do you like your job? They're going to say, no, I hate my job. Or, I like my job, I like the people there, whatever, but like, do you like what you do? Not really. Or it's okay. Like, it's just apathy. But in the end, apathy will always turn into hatred. Like, you will, like, if you don't get up in the morning most days and think, man, I get to go to work today, you don't really like your job, and most of us don't like our job. Whether it's the commitment to a schedule, whether it's the actual thing that we do. And then what most people do when they want a business, they take the skills that they have from their job and they use it to build a business doing the same job but for themselves. That improves things for a while. But it's when we find what we are actually experts in, not because we went to school for it, but because we are so driven by it that we want to be, that we find what we love. And if you do what you love every day, you never really work a day in your life. Now, you will still have things that you don't want to do that you need to do within the day. Do that first. Do that first. Get that done first, and your productivity will go up. Everything's downhill after it. But basically, you can spend your life earning a living doing something you love, or you can spend your life earning a living doing something you hate, and there's not a lot of alternatives. All there is a meter in the middle, which is basically love it a lot, love it a little bit, like it and kind of love it, or you go into hatred side. Don't like it, and it just how far up does the volume of hatred go? And most people, by the end of their career, if they stay in that same space the whole time, I don't ever want to do this ever again. This is why the best mechanics often drive shitty cars. They work on other people's cars all day. Maybe they liked working on cars. Maybe they were a shade tree mechanic. They grew up tuning up cars and they really, really loved it. But 10, 15 years in, your back hurts and you don't really like it anymore. But you get paid so well, you can't go do something else. But you could. And you could take the expertise in automotive and do something totally different than just changing timing belts and starter motors and doing oil changes every day. You could go to a higher level with it. You could do something like Charles the Humble Mechanic did with it. If you take those expertise, blow them out, and become known for it. So it's your choice when you say, but I don't want to do that. Yes, but then what do you want? And the biggest problem so many people have is they don't know what they want. Once you define what you really want and you have the answer, you're going to find that it's going to be almost impossible. Maybe it won't be impossible not to become a known expert, but it will be impossible not to become an expert. Because here's something that Sue LaPrise said to me when we were thinking about starting to homeschool the kids, and we had some apprehension with it, and my wife more than me, and I understand because she's the one who has to do it, and I sit in here and do my job, right? But what Sue said is you can just stop worrying. They're going to learn what they need to know, and they're going to learn what they want to know. But this was the impactful thing. She said you cannot prevent a child from learning a thing that they have decided that they want to learn. They will find out. They'll ask their friends. They'll go on the internet. I don't care what filter you put on. One way or another, if they have decided, I wish to learn this thing, you will be unable to prevent it. And if a child has decided they refuse to learn a thing, you can't make them. All you can do is try to reason with them and help them understand why it's in their best interest. But until they decide they want to learn it, they're not going to learn it. And it's no different when they're sitting at public school. The teacher in public school has the same dilemma and pretends they don't. You know that you have the dilemma. You will accept it. It's your kid. You love them more. Go ahead and do it. You can change that whole lesson to person. It is impossible to force a person to learn something that they choose not to learn. And it is impossible to prevent a person from learning something they want to learn. I guarantee you anything you really want to learn, nothing and no one can prevent it. Nothing and no one can prevent it. You're like, damn you, I'm going to go. In fact, when somebody tells you you can't do it, you're going to go do it. Now, I mean knowledge, not necessarily skill. Like, some people will never be a good guitar player, and some people are instantly a good guitar player, right? And some people, no matter how hard they try, they might, like, there are certain things that are talent-based from a skill level, but you're going to find that, like, you like the idea of playing guitar. If you really can't do it, you're not going to love learning. When you find the thing that you really think you love, and then when you start learning, you love learning about it, you're in the wheelhouse of your passion. And that is unstoppable. And if you take that and develop expertise and market them, I guarantee you one way or another, you can figure out how to monetize that and develop a life where you earn a living doing what you love instead of what you hate. But the choice, as always, is yours. With that, I'll wrap things up. I want to remind you, if you like the segment I just did, and you want more of a little bit of life ass-kicking in your life to take your entire life to another level, check out Laws of Life, Ditch the System, Design Your Life by me, Jack Spirko, available on Amazon. And remember, you can buy it going through tspaz.com, and if you shop online at tspaz.com, you help us out no matter what you buy. Those of you who signed up for the AI course, we start Monday morning. Make sure you're on the the Telegram group and list where you belong, and be ready to go then. Everyone else, I'll catch you next week. You'll have a Friday flashback tomorrow. Have a great weekend. Make it productive. Become an expert in something.
You should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.